family history, take one.
I said we'd have to wait till I had my cup of coffee.
It's July 6, 1986.
Tomorrow is Henry and Cindy's anniversary.
I have a card in the car.
You do? You want to take one for me, too?
Sure. Okay, so who were your parents?
My mother's name was Hazel Elizabeth Caroline Cowdy.
Where did she grow up?
St. Louis.
Was she born in St. Louis?
Mm-hmm. I had four brothers, whose names I can seldom remember. Elmer was the oldest. Elmer, Harold, Raymond. I have it written down someplace. Raymond and... Sorry, we'll have to look that one up. One of them died before when mother was either very little or before she was born. They were all very tall men, 6+, and mother was only 4'10". Tiny. She was the last one, and tiny, but beautiful, dark red hair.
How ill was your mother born?
You shouldn't waste tape.
We've got hours over here.
What year? Dad was born in 1888. Mother was born in 1893. They were 5 years apart. I don't know how old mother's brothers were. Most of them left St. Louis. I guess all of them did. Harold was a salesman for some large corporation, and he'd pop into St. Louis every now and then when he had to come to talk to the companies. I don't know what he sold, but there were lots of drug companies in St. Louis, so I always had a feeling maybe he was connected with them. Elmer ran away from home, the oldest, and went on the stage. Shocking thing to happen in those days. So Elmer married a beautiful woman named Eula Parmalee, who I think was at St. Louis, and I'm not sure. She could play the piano like nobody else. And they had one daughter whose name was Dorothy. And I saw Dorothy for the last time when she was about 8 years old. I have no idea what happened to Dorothy.
And these are all counties, right?
Yeah, these are counties. So Dorothy is my only cousin. First cousin. I think she married somebody in Wisconsin or Michigan. Anyway, they traveled on the Orpheum circuit all over the world. I think Dorothy was born in China. In burlesque, song and dance. They weren't called musical comedies then. Mm-hmm. But whenever Elmer would come back to St. Louis, of course, Mother and Dad and all their friends would go see Elmer perform. They wouldn't take us because it might be a little bit off color. So Sister and I never, of course, we were little girls too. Now let's see.
How about your dad's side?
Dad, this needs some research. Dad was born in Moberly, Missouri, mm-hmm. which is down the pike and just a little north. Mm-hmm. And I always thought he was an only child. No, this is mixed. I thought that he was the only child.
And you're talking, I'll listen.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Okay, I'm eating a piece of bacon. For a while, I thought that Uncle Ernie was Dad's older brother because they weren't too far apart, only to discover at a much later date when I was growing up that Uncle Ernie was Grandfather Hulbert's very much younger brother. And I don't know what happened, but I think the Hulberts took in raised, helped to raise Uncle Ernie. So he was like an older brother to Dad, though technically he was his uncle. Other than that, now Uncle Ernie told me before he died that Dad had had two sisters. Both died in infancy. I never knew anything about this. But they're all in the cemetery up there at Moberly, and it wouldn't be hard to find out. There was another one.
What cemetery is it?
I don't know. I have it written down. I have a whole box at the top of the stairs in the loft filled with pictures and family history because I started to work on this, Greg. Mm-hmm. Look at that. These darn pills are destroying everything. How do you do, dear?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Turn it off.
Where's the off here? Oh, we're just...
Is it on?
Yeah.
Uncle Ernie's name was Ernest Albert. Albert. Grandfather's name was Henry... Henry Ernest Albert.
That's your grandfather.
Mm-hmm. And we called him Old Hoss. That was long before Bonanza. Dad called Sister Bill and me Buster. So we had lots of nicknames in our household. Okay, now Nan, my grandmother, whose name was Nan. Oh, by the way, sister's name was Harriet Nan Albert. She was named after both grandmothers.
Nan was on your mother or father's side?
Father's mother.
Okay.
Her real name was Ella Knowles. I don't know if she had a middle name or not. I'll have to look that up. But everybody called her Nan, or Nanny, as we did when we were children. So sister was named Harriet Nan. Nan was born in Leedsport, New York, which was on the Erie Canal. John and I stopped there on the way to Lex's first marriage. And, of course, the courthouse was burned down, and ancient records were gone. And the historical, it was getting towards a weekend, the Historical Society was, the person who ran that was not there. So that we could not really find anything. The old cemetery had been moved. But I have some pictures, some tintypes of either Nan's brothers or uncles, and those are the letters I have from the Civil War. They would write home for blankets, for rice. Army didn't feed, they were Union soldiers, and the Army didn't feed them very well. And both of them died. One of pneumonia, I believe. He was sent home, but he then died. And I don't know what the other one. Nan was born in about either 1863 or 1865. And Henry, no, it's in my safety deposit box. There's a silver dollar, an old silver dollar, with a hole punched through it. And that's what, they tied it around her neck, and that's what she teethed on. They're little babies, and of course it was a silver in those days, and silver was perfectly all right for little children to chew on. So that was her teething. Those are my Gigi books. Okay, Ernie's mother, Old Hoss and Ernie's mother, look at that.
Old Hoss is in a white plastic frame with oval picture with a little...
But look, this is my writing, and it's Old Hoss and Ernie's mother, and her name was Rebecca Jane Lucan. That brings the Lucans into the family. Okay, that was their mother.
Jeepers, look at that picture.
Upstairs on the wall in the blue room is an oval picture, and that was my grandmother on the county center. That's my great-grandmother.
So that's my great-great-grandmother.
It sure is. Wow. Now, Uncle Ernie must have given me this one. And I didn't remember a thing about it, but I wrote on the back.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that there was a Lupin someplace in the family because there was an Aunt Lulu Lupin when I was a girl that lived in Moberly. We used to go up to the farm and visit her from St. Louis. And that's where I first picked strawberries, first saw strawberries growing, because I was real little. And you know what a feather bed is? I went to, they put me in a feather bed, and it completely came up around me like this and almost smothered me. You know, it was like great fluff feathers. So Aunt Lulu must have been, I know she was Dad's aunt, so it must have been great aunt, I guess. I'll be darned. Okay.
So your dad's from Moberly.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's a Hulbert, a grave site in Moberly.
H-U-L-B-U-R-D. There's also a Hulbert Highway in Kansas, which I wrote down the number of it, and I'm going to write to the state Department of Highways and find out where there's a Hulbert. So I'm 70 going west.
Hmm.
Just out between Lawrence and Topeka. But Dad, when Dad was an infant, he was very sickly. And because they had lost these two girls anyway, now this came from Ernest, Uncle Ernie, they moved to St. Louis to get better medicine. It was not at all unusual in those days to lose infants. You know, there was diphtheria and childbed fever and all sorts of things. And they lived down, what was, of course, it's downtown now, right next to one house that has been restored called the Campbell House in St. Louis. So it was the same type of straight-up house. And the doctor recommended that they move to the country, which would be better for the baby's health. So they moved out to Ferguson, which was a suburb. It was a little village, but up near Jennings, where John was born. So Dad grew up in Ferguson. And I remember Grandmother's house, the house, it was a white Victorian with gingerbread on the porches and a little funny tower coming up in front with a pointed roof on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know this, I didn't know it, but when Dad came to visit us in New Jersey, and we were talking about how difficult it was for people with children to rent apartments and things, and he said, well, Bets, it was the same thing when you were little, after World War II and I. He said, apartments simply didn't want children. And he said, we had to live in Ferguson for about 6 months with Nan and Dad, Nan and Old Hoss, because we couldn't find any place to live with two little girls. So I discovered that not only did we visit Ferguson, but we lived there for a while. So children were discriminated against. Well, let me make, you haven't got that on. If you have, turn it off. We lived on Forest Park Boulevard. Oh, Ferguson. Oh, this belonged to Grandmother Nan, because Mrs. H.E., that would be Henry Ernest Hulbert, on, oh, this is their address in Ferguson. Look at that, I don't know, could look up the road. I know the house isn't there anymore. There was a big pond across the street, January Pond. That's your grandfather. Wasn't he a good-looking dude?
Oh.
So that's Grandpa Dutch.
Yeah, he was 19 when that was taken, as I recall.
It's a picture without a frame.
Probably.
The young guy in a bow tie and a vest.
Uh-huh.
His hands in his pocket.
Right. Cuffs on his jacket. suit coat too.
Puff's on the suit coat too. Just trying to record which is which here.
Oh, I thought I gave that to Henry. Grandpa Dutch's baby clothes.
A box of Grandpa Dutch's baby clothes. Looks like baby clothes to me.
I think it was his christening dress, I'm not sure. Oh, tintype of Grandfather Hulbert. It's not in here, so it's in the book that I started. I hate to tell you, I think this is Uncle Ernie in his Spanish-American uniform. He had that. He had an old picture reproduced.
Well, this is Uncle Ernie.
Yeah, he was in. He and Grandfather were both in the Spanish-American War.
In a hand-painted picture. That's a horrible picture.
Isn't that terrible? Well, it was taken from an old, old photograph. And I think you know who that is.
Yeah, that's Ted.
Okay. Let's go cook something for John, see if he's okay. I have a million notes, but I've never pulled it together.
Mm-hmm. What are all these letters in this brown?
All right, those are the Civil War letters from nannies. Either brothers. Cindy thinks they might have been her uncles. And you can pull them out and read them. And there's a tintype in there. Mm-hmm. One of these books, I have two of them. One's for the Cowdies and one's for the Hulberts.
Clothing accounted for 1861 and 2, price list. Overcoat, Deft's coat, pants, blouse, drawers, shirts, caps, shoes, boots, knap, sack, hand straps, haversack, canteen, blankets, shoulder scales, socks. Okay. Adams Express Company, forwarder.
You can pull any of those out, honey. I'm not sure that's the right plastic to keep old things in, but it's the only one that...
December 15th, 83 received.
All right, Mrs. Hines' name was Rose. Rose Turner.
Rose Turner.
But Turner was her first married name. Okay. Old Hoss was born in Hudsonville, Illinois.
Okay.
I do know that Grandfather Cowdy's death certificate is wrong. He was 96 years old or something when he died, and they have him down for about 76. The doctor goofed. Oh, I hate to take pills now. Is that thing on?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be.
Come on.
We're not talking.
Oh, you're talking.
Let's see what you're looking at.
It looks like it might be a discharge paper or something.
It is. George H. Knowles. Assistant Surgeon of the U.S. Army. Now, because of these letters and discharge papers, and these are the letters home, I think.
Okay.
My brother was able to obtain a scholarship to Washington University in St. Louis. Anyone that could prove that they had ancestors on the Union side, there was this scholarship for them, because so much of St. Louis was the Confederacy.
Is the scholarship still there?
Well, I imagine it's just like the old Hines scholarship in that it was so small that they bundled a lot of these scholarships together. Mm. But because of the proof of those letters, Dad was able to prove that Bud had ancestors on the Union side of the Civil War. Because we had Union sympathizers and we had Confederate sympathizers.
Well, that's important. I mean, maybe Henry wants to send little Charlie to Washington U and you get a scholarship.
Well, it would be some sort of scholarship help money. But isn't that an interesting, as Dad said when he discovered this, he said it's amazing if you can dig back into the scholarship records of what people gave scholarships for.
Sure. Makes sense. Well, didn't Dad go to Yale on some kind of unusual scholarship?
No. The Hines Scholarship. No, Dad went to Smith Academy or Manual Training, which were boys' schools that were developed by Washington University before Mary Institute. You see, Mary Institute was affiliated with Washington University until the mid-50s or something. Mm-hmm. And then he went to Washington University, and then later, when Sister and I were little, he went to St. Louis University School of Business. I have no idea of the years or anything else. None. He also went to Ferguson High School. That's where he played football. I have to find those photographs.
Huh, looks like George H. Knowles died. Here's a certificate in 1868 for $100 to the parents of deceased.
Is he the one that got pneumonia?
Private, the New York Artillery. Bounty allowed by Act of July 28, 1868. Reedport, New York. Discharge and disbandment. Frederick Knowles, private, Company B.
Cindy helped put those letters in, and Cindy and Henry were out, I don't know, did this probably 4 years ago, and she, in reading, she's the one that said, I think these were your grandmother's uncles. She said, if your grandmother was born in about 63 or 68 or something.
Man, it was 1868.
68. Well, you see, these were already young boys fighting in the war. So they probably were her uncles, not her brothers.
Yeah.
There's a tintype of both of them in there.
Yeah, I saw. So these are basically letters from your grandmother's...
Knowles.
Knowles.
Who married a Hulbert.
So these are on your father's side.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. A Knowles married a Hulbert. So it would have been your...
They met
grandmother's uncles.
That's right. Now,
wow.
I don't know when the Knowles came to this country, and I do not know from whence they came. I do not know when the Hulberts came to this country, although it was all before Lady Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
The Sewards came to the country in, I think it's 1617, into Virginia. And you can find out anything you want from the Sword House, Sword Mansion in Auburn, New York. I'm even in one of the little published books, the branch of the Sword. They had all the cousins write histories of their branch in St. Louis. And my great uncle, Upton, Grandfather Cowdy had three. Twin brothers, Upton and Lee, named after generals in the Civil War. And great uncle Upton wrote the St. Louis chapter, and I mentioned in that, Sister and I was something like 2 or 3 years old when that was written. Anyway, it's published and it's sitting, copies of it are sitting in the museum up there. They have a huge room of genealogy. And I thought one of these days I really should write them and say I'm on page 16, paragraph 35 of this book, and these are the children that I have, so that they could continue down a line.
Oh.
I have all the DAR papers, too. I think they're in my safety deposit box. The daughters. You all do know. Did you get that article on Vernon Skeeto?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
When we went up to, when Dad and Bill McKelvey went up to find a skiing area, Grandfather Cowdy wrote me and said that Colonel John Seward was buried in a cemetery in Vernon County, New Jersey.
Say again?
Vernon County, New Jersey was where Colonel John Seward, who was the Revolutionary War ancestor, was buried in the same place that Kurt was looking for skiing area.
Mm-hmm.
We found one little Revolutionary War cemetery under a tree. Your father wasn't very interested in stopping to read things like that. All weed grown, about four or five headstones all flat on the ground, you know. And we could not find anything. I imagine a historical society now has restored that little cemetery. But Colonel John Seward was buried in that area someplace. So that would have been the Revolutionary War ancestor. It's in that book. I think I have it in here. It's something very interesting. One thing that impresses me so, yes, it's this. That was my grandmother's handwriting. They all wrote so beautifully. Now, those are her ancestors.
Hmm.
And the ink's beginning to fade.
Isaac Knoll, born March 28, 1811, it looks like.
That could have been her father.
Charles S. Hickman, born April 7th, 1811. Isaac Knowles, married to somebody, September 15th or 5th, 1831. Fernando, somebody Knowles, born.
This is Dickinson.
Dickinson.
Fernando. Looks like Jerome, doesn't it?
Jerome Knowles.
Born.
36.
36.
George.
He would have been the kid in the war. George Henry Knowles, born April. Now, my father sensibly wrote that out on the typewriter many, many, many years ago.
Oh, thanks. Grandpa Dutch, that was smart.
Now this is
so
is the tin tap of the two.
Right.
Men.
So this is basically
same thing on the other side.
Right.
So this would have been Nan's mother, Charlotte Dickinson.
Charlotte L. Dickinson, born April 7th, 1811, would have been Nan's mother. And Nan was your grandmother.
That could have been Nan's grandmother because Nan was born in 68,
right.
And this is 11, that's 50 years old. That would have been her grandmother.
Would have been her grandmother.
Now, all those generations were all in this country already.
Right.
I simply do not know when they came over. But this would have been sailing ship days.
Oh, yeah.
Growing up, Grandmother Cowdy was around the house far more frequently than Grandmother Hulbert. I think this is a standard procedure. Normally, the woman's parents are in the home more than the in-laws.
Hmm.
and the so, and of course, mother and sister just adored Grandmother County, and so did I. But since they're both gone, and in thinking back, Grandmother Hulbert taught me, I learned much more from Grandmother Hulbert than I did from Grandmother County. And I think she was the more intelligent of the two. You know, this is all retrospect. But in memory, the one that I knew the least, I knew them both well, but the one that I knew the least, I think I received more from her. Now, Grandmother County's father, I have notes on this someplace, was a riverboat captain, I think. And she was born in Pittsburgh, but I know darn well they lived in Tennessee someplace. So her mother must have been on the trip with her father when she was born. But she was born in Pittsburgh. And the, of course, riverboat captains were, that was quite an important job in those days. They were reasonably well-to-do people. You had to get everything down the Ohio, the Monongahela and the Ohio down to the Mississippi to get things going west.
So if Charlotte Dickinson was Nan's grandmother, who is Nan's mother?
I don't know. Look it up. But Charlotte would not have been having a baby if she was 50 years old.
Probably not.
See? So look on the back side.
Oh, okay, so it would have been, well, but the rest is all boys. Isaac Knowles, Fernando Jerome, George Henry.
All right, but that's following just the Knowles side.
Right.
It says Knowles family.
Right.
So,
I'm confused.
Some broad was brought in there someplace along the line. But as I say, that's as far as I got. But did you read those letters? Pull the letters out and see if you can still read them.
Sure.
Maybe they're in wrong plastic. You see them, maybe they'll be ruined. Okay. Kind of pathetic. Please send me blankets to keep me warm.
I'm again in Newborn, safe and sound. I received a letter from you yesterday and was glad to hear that you was all well. Those postage stamps was just the thing that I wanted. You wrote that you gave, that you was giving to send my box the same day that you sent the letter, but I have not got it yet, but wish that I had one of those fried cakes now. Just had a good plate of broiled rice with butter and sugar on it. We can draw rice anytime we want it. We generally have this dish with a quart of coffee for supper. Be interesting. Well, this is G.H. Knowles. Good old G.H. Knowles must be.
That's George.
George Henry Knowles, born 43.
20 years older than Nan.
Yeah, 23 years old.
So that's an uncle. George is an uncle. Was an uncle.
And George was one of the guys who died.
Yeah, I think the other one did too. So Isaac must have been her father or grandfather. Where's Fernando? Oh, there are claims for his clothes and his trunk that was lost. And there are lots of receipts from the Attorney General or the head of the Army or something for $20 to help with the burial. And,
and all in here.
Yeah.
Interesting. know, it's hard to read this stuff.
I think they're fading in that plastic. You may take it out to read it, for heaven's sakes, Greg, and maybe they'd better be taken out and aired. There's some plastic that you can use on ancient documents, but other plastic it seems you can't, and I'll bet this is the plastic that you can't. What gets me is that everybody had such beautiful handwriting, and of course all this stuff was done by hand. You had scribes sitting up on big stools writing all these official things by hand.
Mm-hmm. George Knowles Estate to William Watson to coffin box and attend funeral. George Knowles deceased, $16. Repayment in full. And George Knowles died of what during the war?
I think he got pneumonia. Anyway, whatever I know is in those letters. I
wonder what...
There's a letter from the Surgeon General, I think, saying that... what he got, I don't know.
Hmm. Interesting. Enclosed, you will find a certificate for $152.72 payable to father of the deceased, to George Knoll, late private of Captain Angles Company, New York Artillery, for services on the 31st day of August, when January, the time of his death, $100 bounty. By the act of, but respectively. So I guess if you got killed, they paid your folks $100, huh?
Well, that may have, it was called a bounty?
Yeah.
I think that was the bonus for having lost a son or something.
So, where were you born?
I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, on August 29th, 1917.
1917.
At St. Louis Maternity Hospital.
St. Louis Maternity Hospital is still there?
No. I think Dick Bradley was the last baby to be born in St. Louis Maternity Hospital, or the first one to be born when it became part of Barnes Hospital. But he was either the last or the first. So St. Louis Maternity is now part of Barnes. Has been for many years. Now, my brother was born at St. Louis Maternity Hospital, and so was sister. No, brother was born at St. Luke's on Del. All was born in St. Louis.
And when was your sister born?
She was born April 12, 1916. She was 16 months older than I.
And when was your brother born?
August 13th. And I don't know. I don't remember. I think it was 28. I have it down someplace, and it would be very easy to find.
No. When did your brother die?
49.
In an airplane crash, right?
Mm-hmm. St. Louis County. He flew into the ground. It was 49. He was 21 years old.
Well, that would have been 28.
Mm-hmm.
Was he piloting the airplane?
As far as we know, he was.
Was he the only one in the airplane?
No, there were two. He was with an inspector whom he aided.
Oh.
And the inspector was to retire the following Monday, and they disappeared on Friday night. Because the inspector had a very bad heart condition. And Brother Bud did not want to fly with him at all. And So we don't know. The man was a mighty big man. We don't know whether he had a heart attack and fell across the controls or what. But the plane evidently flew right into the ground, you know, bleh. And Brother Bud was just being separated from the Marine Corps at that time. And was due to go to Washington University starting with the that new semester. The winter semester. Too bad.
And where'd you go to school?
I went to University City Public Schools until through the fourth grade, and then went to Mary Institute.
Oh, so you went to University City.
Went to University City Public School, and I think it was when I was, well, I know it was 9 years old when I started to wear glasses. But in those days, the smart kids sat in the back of the room, and the mischievous or dumb kids sat in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always in the back of the room, and one day, I couldn't see the board. So I raised my hand, and Miss Pemberton was her name, said, "Yes, Betty, you may come down front," because our test was on the, written on the board. And everyone went, yeah, she wants to look at my paper, you know, as I walked down the aisle. And I sat down front, and she sent a note home to my parents and said, "I think something has happened to Betty's eyes. She's never had trouble with the blackboard before." So I went to the eye doctor and got my glasses on December 5th, which just so happened to be my grandmother Cowdy's birthday. And Mother cried and cried and cried because no little girls wore glasses. It was unheard of. So I was teased to death at school. And maybe that's why I went to Mary Institute the next year. I don't know.
Did you go to Mary's?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dee Dee didn't wear glasses, right?
No, she didn't wear glasses until a few years ago when she got some reading glasses, which she seldom wore anyway, just for reading. She had good eyes. Mother had good eyes. My brother had such exceptional vision that he was on the Marine Olympics shooting squad, the only private in the place. And he said they had wonderful times during the daytime, but at night, when the shooting was over, you know, the contests for the day, he'd go over to the barracks someplace while the generals and the colonels and the captains and everything would all be able to go out to dinner with each other, but he couldn't. He said we were all equal as long as we were shooting, but as soon as the day was over, then they had to salute and do all the other things. Maybe he was a corporal by then. I guess he was. But he was not an equal. And that's why he got duty that he just hated. He was a guard at the Naval Retraining Center, someplace in Maryland or Delaware, someplace in there. And what that was a prison for the Navy. The Marines guarded it. And for their extremely dangerous prisoners. And Bud said that they were taught to shoot to kill if somebody tried to get out of there. He said there was just no, you know, he said, "Thank the good Lord, nobody ever came under my tower or when I was on duty." Because he said, "I don't know that I could have shot one of my countrymen, you know, no matter what." But he was such a good shot, and that was supposed to be gravy. You know, that was just a top-notch assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And he just hated it. Just terrible.
So when did you graduate from Mary I?
In 1935.
And when did your sister graduate? Probably
in 1933.
Where'd you go to school?
Finch.
Finch.
In New York.
When did you graduate from Finch?
I did not.
Oh.
What did Bench, you do then? Bench was a very great mistake for your mother. The sister went to Finch, and all my life, my family thought I should follow sister in everything she did. You know, if she was good in one thing, I'd promptly try to be good in something else. And, but there was this feeling that you follow in your sister's footsteps, which made life, some life, very difficult for me. But in other ways, it was extremely helpful to me, too. But I was supposed to go to Europe for the winter in September 35 with a chaperone named Madame Lincoln, Mrs. Lincoln, Atwell T. Lincoln, who was a proper chaperone for proper girls in St. Louis. And it's one of those things where you signed up when you were practically born in order to go with her. And a group of five were going.
Side two, family history.
Hitler made the very big mistake of marching into Czechoslovakia or something like that, so our trip had to be postponed. And it was to be postponed until about Christmas time. And Mother looked at me and she said, well, you're not going to hang around the house till Christmas time. She picked up the phone and called Finch, and they said, sure, they could take me. So off I went to Finch. What I wanted to do was go to Smith. And I was college material. I should have. Well, anyway. I went to Finch.
Mm-hmm.
And not much time to get ready to go to Finch, I might say. But had an absolutely wonderful time. Being in New York was very exciting. Finch had a box at the opera, a box at the symphony. And then there were all those St. Louis boys that went to Yale and Harvard and Union and Princeton and Annapolis and West Point. And we were allowed a certain number of weekends per term. Only three, I think. But Mother wrote the school and said that Betty could, you had to list the boys that your daughter could go out with. School was very strict about things like that. And Mother wrote and said that I could take these weekends to go wherever I was invited.
Mm-hmm.
We could go out on Friday nights. Now understand, we were grown up. We had to be back at school by 11:55.
Hmm.
We couldn't stay out later. You could, let's see. I think it was only have one date a weekend if you were in New York. And if you were at school. So consequently, we would stay at the Barbizon Hotel for women or the Westin, which had two floors for women in it, if we were going to have a weekend in New York rather than going back to school. But I had a wonderful time. Mary Collins Spencer, very dear friend from St. Louis, and I, we had to go to church on Sundays. So what we would do, get on the Fifth Avenue buses, sit on top, the open-air bus. And we went to Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox. We did not go to a synagogue because we didn't know anything about it. We went to St. Pat's. You know, we went to all the different churches and would sit on that bus and just have a thoroughly good time. What else? Anyway, it was great. Scholastically, it was an absolute failure. I think I hated every minute of it. For one thing, I was put in the same department as sister had graduated from, which was the drama department. And I was no more interested in getting up on a stage and trying to perform than I was good at scenery, making scenery. I was very good at makeup. But one day, the head of the department got me up in front of the whole class, the whole department, and said, why can you not have one-tenth the talent that your sister did? Sister was a smashing success on the stage. And there were pictures of her all over the drama department walls and everything, photographs. And I was just an absolute flop. But she didn't have to tell me publicly, did she?
I agree.
Uh-huh. So it was not a happy time from that point of view. But I certainly had a good time. Well, I'm going to go put on some clothes. The Finch's experience reminded me that, you know, this was the days of hats and gloves for trapping, and you always dressed up when you went to football games and so forth. And we played tennis as part of our physical education in the 33rd Street Armory. So we would get on the subway with tennis shorts and tennis tops and carrying our tennis rackets. And we had to wear coats to cover so that no one would know we were in shorts. Gloves, a hat, and tennis shoes. Can't you see a bunch of girls getting on the subway to go down to 33rd Street Armory? Every morning after breakfast, we had to take a walk. So we would all go right over to Central Park and hide under the bridges and viaducts and smoke. But if you walked, I think it was 16 blocks down or up, north or south. Those are the short blocks. That was a mile. And if you walked so many of the long blocks, that was a mile. So we usually get in several miles of walking every day. Okay, goodbye.
Where's this?
From Nan to Nan, from Harriet with Love. Harriet was my other grandmother. So, anyway, this is falling apart. I put those albums in a very safe place so the mice wouldn't get them. That's why I think they're probably under our bed in the bedroom.
I'll go look.
Can we go look?
You think you could wiggle through that? All our photographs.
Like?
They're old, old black. Like that.
Okay. How big?
And they're two.
Okay. We're covering their covers.
Black. And they're falling apart. Where's the stuff? Death certificate.
From here. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what he wanted a death certificate for.
Well, I think he probably wanted, I don't know, just for family records, I presume.
There are some old pictures.
Those are Hein boys.
Yeah, that's my boy.
That was an Easter Sunday, as I recall. April.
Standing on the hearth.
Uh-huh.
Greg in his
Cub Scout
uni.
And this is the jacket you had on in that other photograph.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday school jackets went down through the family. Or to Larry Miller and then back to the next one down. So these all have to be, oh, sure.
Who's that?
That's you and that's Ted.
Baby picture.
Isn't that cute?
2-year-old Ted.
Ted at 6 months. That's you, 6 months.
Uh-huh.
That's Ted at a year and a half or 2 years or whatever. That is cute.
Uh-huh.
Adorable little kids. The very best. Art Monk Learney.
That's your Aunt Barney. Aunt Barney.
Dear sweet thing.
What year did he die?
72, I think. 71 or 2, I've got it written down in my birthday book. So. And Aunt Alice died. Well, just a few years before. He fell. They had both had a very bad siege of the flu. And the doctor would not let them go back to their house until they had completely recovered. But to get them out of the hospital, he suggested this nursing home. Well, Uncle Ernie and Aunt Alice had a big room in the back so that they could be together. And he improved rapidly, and she didn't do so well, and pretty soon she couldn't defeat the pneumonia or something and died. So he, at her funeral, he slipped and fell and broke his hip, getting into the limousine, I think, after the funeral. So he had to go back to the nursing home instead of going home to his home. And he stayed there. That was where he stayed the rest of his life. Eventually he sold his car and he sold his house and I guess everything in it. And because when his hip healed, then he developed kidney problems. And then, you know, from that thing, one thing after another. And so he was there for the rest of his life, and that must have been maybe 5 years. And that's when I got involved. And it was while we were still in St. Louis. One summer, when we'd spent the summer up in Wisconsin, I arrived home to find a letter from his lawyer, who was a reasonably young man, whose father had been Ernie's lawyer, and stating that his Uncle Ernie had always said that in case anything happened, that I should be notified. And he told me about Aunt Alice's death, and they had tried to get in touch with me all summer while I wasn't home. And so would I please be kind enough to write to him if this letter reached me and so forth, which I did. And from that time on, I was involved with Uncle Ernie's affairs, like the nurses who swore up and down they were going to marry the old bastard, and the nurse that reported that one of the other nurses was trying to poison him. Remember when I took that trip down? Oh, boy. I took more trips down to poor old fellow. He was well taken care of, and if he'd lived much longer, he would have been flat broke because he insisted on private nurses so that he could, for company, more than anything else. And 1 year it cost him over $30,000 to live in that nursing home. And that was, 20-something years ago, and that was a lot of money to be spending in those days. And of course, one of his nurses got his charge cards and everything, and she was wearing diamonds all over both hands, both wrists, and in her ears. So, poor old fellow didn't have, and he was afraid that he would lose them if he reported what. Now, not all his nurses were this way, but if he reported them out of order, he was afraid they would threaten to leave him and wouldn't take care of him anymore.
And he was, Uncle Ernie was your dad's brother?
No,
your dad's
grandfather's brother.
He was your grandfather.
But he was just a few years older than my father. I mean, a few years, maybe 10. And I thought for many years that he was my dad's older brother, because for a long time they were raised together. But obviously not. He was my dad's uncle.
Now, okay, so you're...
He may have been a stepbrother to Dad. I mean, maybe it's the same situation that the Hine, old Samuel Hine, who married twice and had two separate families. You know, your Bessie Cates or someone like that, or maybe it was Cornelia Hall. Oh, I think it was Bessie, was your father's first cousin, but she was 60-some-odd years older than your father because of these massive differences in the ages of the old gentleman Samuel's two wives. Emma Kirtland was his second wife, and she was only about 19 when they were married. and she's the one that had all the Hine brothers and Aunt Nell. But there was this first family way up here that Sam had hit.
Hmm.
So it's a strange mixture.
Hmm.
So that's, well, I put those darn things someplace.
Oh, that's okay.
Well, it isn't. Now that we're on it, I want to find them.
Okay.
But let's see what else John brought down. See, I put them safe because we do have Mike. So that's not important either.
That's your dead scrapper.
Uh-huh. Oh, this is neat. This was a party at our house for me. This was the night I made my debut. And a lot of people stayed for me. There's Auden.
That's Auden, yes.
This was our living room.
This is on Vandeventer?
Uh-huh. This is Auden's brother, Jim.
Huh, didn't know that.
And his girl, ex-sister.
Uh-huh.
This is Mary Spencer, the gal I went to Finch with. That's me. Frank Corley, a beau. That's me.
So this is your Gigi book?
Yeah, this is my debutante Gigi book. There's Auden.
Uh-huh.
This is the gal I went to Europe with this summer after Finch. Pictures of me. Front porch of Vandeventer Place, those atrocious, great, big
balls.
Yeah. Well, it was very Victorian. So, yeah, Mary Ann Martin, do you remember her?
Uh-huh.
Oh, somebody gave Mary Collins Spencer a party on a coach.
Mm-hmm.
We rode all over mid-St. Louis, and this was the coaching, whatever they call them, and it was quite a party.
Hmm.
I know, this doesn't go as far as Sister and me in Bermuda.
Mm. Here we are in Bermuda.
Oh, way back in the 30s. Leaving for a football game or for something. See, we all wore hats on trains. Leo Junior Prom. Well, that's where I was going, obviously. Sandy McIntosh. This is the dance program. Remember the McIntoshes?
Sure.
I
assume they're still in Wellesley or someplace.
I haven't heard from them for a long, long time. Perhaps mid-St. Louis days.
Wow.
Bermuda
Line. Telegram I almost sent Ellie.
What does that say? Oh, I don't know what that's on there. Bermuda. Hearing normal.
It's all this. Coronation Ball at the Women's Club.
Mary Institute Horse Show. Don't tell me I.
Coronation Ball at the Women's Club. Who's this? Who's Mary Ann Current?
That was Harry Baumstark's wife. Anne and Harry. Oh, yes. Yeah. There are the two Hulford sisters. There's Andy.
Hmm.
Fun in the country.
Fun in the country. That looks
Betty
like
and Dee Dee.
This looks like Dee Dee.
Me.
Well, that's you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mary Alice Collins.
Here's you don't remember Dean Hopkins.
Whoa, here comes the fourth annual Merrimack Club Carnival.
J. Good. Boyd Ware.
Fun. You bring a ticket from any member.
That's Judy's phone.
Right.
Oh, there's Elihu and me.
Where's Elihu doing nowadays?
He's a lawyer in St. Louis. Very, very handsome looking. Far better looking than ever before. He has aged well.
It should be in retirement now.
There I am.
Frank and sister.
No, it's sister, not me.
My swimming, dinner for Jane. Jane who?
Jane Miller was her name. This is the old Belle Reve Country Club. It's now the campus of St. Louis University. Okay. Here's Mother. And there's Dad.
Mrs. H. And Mrs. W.
These are the Millers, the girls' parents that I gave them. Here's Mother. And there's Dad.
One half mother, Peter and Mary.
Yeah, Peter Sanders. That was her nickname, Peter.
Oh. Hmm. Quite a crew.
And here's when Jane was married, that girl. That's it.
Mother's Gigi book.
One of them. I've got lots of these.
Oh, you do, huh?
Many, many. Well, I'm sorry I can't find that.
That's okay.
Oh, you turned it on again.
Sure.
Oh, dear. Well, it's not okay. See, never put things in safe places. Because you can't remember where you put them. Once they get out of place... They were here.
Like, more questions here. Like,
what box did this one come out of? This.
Is that where it came?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There. So I did start.
Good job. So what the... Let's see, where were we?
I don't remember.
You were going to Europe.
Oh,
but
we're
Hitler
going
overran Czechoslovakia.
Yes, so it was postponed and I went to Finch instead.
Right.
But those gals, there's a picture of them in that book.
Mm-hmm.
The Gigi book. I think finally left in January. Because I was at Finch and I went down to see them off.
Oh, so you didn't go with them?
Nope. But I went the next summer with that one girl, Effie Zibig, and Madam Lincoln. I have two little Lincoln imps on my bracelets, my memory bracelets.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came home and made my day good.
So what summer did you go to? What summer was that?
Well, I graduated in 35, went to Finch in September 35, finished in 30, it would have been summer of 36.
And then you came home and had your debut.
And made a debut, and that...
When took, was that?
That took a whole year, that would have been 36, 37.
It takes a whole year to do a debut?
Well, it did in those days. Constant parties.
Wow.
And then second year was important.
Second year at Finch.
No, second year at debut.
Oh.
At home, partying. But we did volunteer work. Mother always felt that if you didn't have to work, you should serve the community.
Right.
So from the time I was 11 or 12, I would serve penny lunches in the downtown schools with Mother. Mm-hmm. I suppose it was a church group. But during my holidays, while we'd go down and serve penny lunches, the children would pay a penny if they could afford to. Just amazing. And then I worked at a well baby clinic on Page Avenue. A well baby clinic was where you brought your babies after they were born, again for underprivileged. And they were weighed, measured. In those days, we didn't have shots, many shots for babies. But I volunteered there, and I volunteered at the surgical outpatient clinic at Barnes Hospital. I seem to have always done health care volunteer work, or most of the time. So, and I also taught Sunday school. I had little five-year-old boys. And I do remember one time I just got back from the weekend at Annapolis, so I taught them, they were rather rowdy, and I taught them how a battleship was built with its double watertight compartments. Now, this is way back in the 30s. They're quite different now, I'm sure. But that was one way I could keep my little monsters quiet in Sunday school. And what else?
What did your dad do?
Dad worked.
Where'd he work?
He was the executive secretary of the Collier Estate, which was a large foundation fund thing. And before that, Uncle Ernie told me that when we were little girls, Dad worked for Mallinckrodt, I think, which was a chemical, is a chemical company. And toothpaste was just coming out in those days. So Dad and a friend of his decided they'd go in the toothpaste business. So at night, after working, now Dad would have been in his 20s or something, sort of like your father starting the ski tow, you know. They would come home and put toothpaste in toothpaste tubes. Tubes were brand new then. Before that, I think people brushed with salt, and they brushed with baking soda. And but, you know, the toothpaste in a tube was something really spiff. But Uncle Ernie said that that didn't work out too well, so they stopped stuffing toothpaste in tubes at night. They thought, boy, they were going to get in on this new invention of tubes of toothpaste. Let's see, where else did he work? I'm sure it was Mallinckrodt. And I don't know. I think that was the only place that, those were the only two. Now, there may have been more, you know. I don't know. Grandfather Cowdy was head of the accounting department at Cotton Belt Railroad. And he didn't retire until sometime in the 30s. He must have been 70-some-odd when he retired. I don't think there was a retirement age in those days. He and Grandmother Cowdy celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in, I think it was in the fall, let's say October of 1933. So, I think it was 33. Grandfather Hulbert worked for, John, what railroad went through Moberly? Wabash. Wabash. He had something to do with arranging the packages and postal things of the trains. And Moberly was a railhead in those days for many trains. And sometimes I wondered if that's how Grandmother Nan got there, to Moberly. Because they had lived on the Erie Canal, which was transportation, involved in transportation.
Right.
And so my little fat mind rather thought that when the trains came along, maybe that's how her family got to Moberly. But I can't be sure. The one thing Uncle Ernie told me, that the way that he and Aunt Alice and Grandfather and Nan met was during the Spanish-American War. They were both Red Cross volunteers that served the soldiers. The ladies were Red Cross volunteers that served the soldiers coffee and donuts and things like that. And that's how they met, both Aunt Alice, who was from Tulsa, Oklahoma, or at least that's where her sister lived. And grandmother. So I really do not know where those women really came from, but I just always assumed that grandmother's family had moved to Mobley. So I don't know. That'll be fun to try to trace back.
So is the, what you call it, estate still around?
Or yes.
Your father works?
I don't know. As far as I know, it probably, maybe not. Maybe it is sort of like, maybe it was broken the same way that Henry broke the Hine Trust. You know, these are all things I can look into. Oh, you could certainly look that up for me. I have no idea.
What, So then you went to New York, and, but then you stayed in New York, right? I mean, when did you and Dad get married?
42.
So what did you do from 37 now to 42?
Now, that's an interesting thing. I used to go on weekends up to Yale to visit Elihu. Elihu had a roommate named Howard Bird. Howard Bird used to ski with Kurt Hine and Bob Nymph and Jarvis Larson and Peter Garrett and Gagarin, Serge Gagarin, wasn't that his name? The Russian Count or something. Maybe it's Ted who remembers him, I don't know. Sandy McIntosh, who was called Sandy in those days. And so that, through Elihu, of course, I met his roommate. And then, after they all graduated in 39, and in 39, moved back to New York, and then started seeing Howard Bird again, who was on his way to Africa for Saucony Vacuum Oil Company, and came down with a very, very strange disease, so he was shipped back to this country. He had grown up in England, American parents, but his father was in control of all Chicago Pneumatic Tool Company interests in Europe and was based in England. So Howard grew up in England and spoke many languages and so forth. Anyway, Howard was shipped back to this country with this very, very strange disease, and that would have been in the mid-40s, and was up at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. It was part meningitis and part encephalitis and something else. He was very ill for a long time. And, though I was desperately in love with Howard. Anyway, I went up to the hospital to see him, and one day I rode up in the elevator with a pretty sharp-looking young man. And he got off the elevator first, which I thought was very rude of him. And by George, if he didn't end up in Howard's room visiting Howard, and that was Bob Nymphs. So that's how I met Bob Nymphs. That was
So you didn't know Nymphs during college?
Uh-uh. I knew Howard and Elihu and had met Sandy McIntosh and Jarvis Larson, but I had never met Kurt Hine, whom I heard about. He was never at any of the dances. The boys would say, well, is Kurt coming this weekend, or is this happening this weekend? And they'd always say, no, he and so-and-so went skiing, or he was off skiing. He never went to the football games or the college party weekends. Whereas a lot of his skiing group did, but he never did. But I heard about him. I heard about this Kurt Hine. So I met Bob Nymphs in the hospital room in the 40s of Howard Bird. Somebody's walking by. And so Nymphs called me one time, and I used to go to 6 o'clock in the morning operations with Nymphs. He was then a student, a medical student. And they had the operating rooms that with the gallery around the top where the students, so Bob would suit me up in a white coat and I'd sit up there with the students while we were all looking at gallbladders. Interesting date. And then he'd have to get on the hospital floor, and of course I'd have to go to work. So, but that's how we started getting to know each other. And then one weekend, before the weekend, he called and asked if I could come up to Vermont, to their house in Vermont. So, I did, I don't know how many times. Anyway, that's how I met the Nims and his stepsister, Angela Gelmi, who was Italian, and his sister, of course. I didn't meet Marshall, his brother, until much later, but anyway, I then won in 41, Labor Day weekend, which was a long weekend. I'd been up visiting Howard Bird. It was my vacation. So I visited Howard Bird up at Westerly, Weekapog, near Westerly, Rhode Island. They had a house at the beach because Howard was still recuperating. And got a bus from there for the weekend to go up to visit Bob and his family in Vermont. And that's when your father turned up. So we met on Labor Day weekend of 41 up at NIMS. And we were married in February of 42.
So what was he doing at the time? He must have
been working for Curtis Wright Corporation.
Over at Patterson.
No, I think he was then working out of the propeller division in Caldwell, which was brand new, but the airfield was in Dunellen, New Jersey, down near New Brunswick. So he was commuting, doing a lot of commuting. And the... But anyway, that's how I met Kurt. And I was coming back to New York by bus on Monday, and Bob said to Kurt, for Pete's sakes, why don't you drive her back? So I drove back with Kurt in his brand new Buick, heavily mortgaged Buick, which kept over boiling up. So we'd have to stop at all the little creeks, and I'd fill either my skirt like this, trying to get water back to the car, or hands. We didn't have anything to fill that brand new Buick that was boiling over. So anyway, it was a long and boring trip. It was just terrible. And I wasn't really very impressed with your husband. Your father. He was very abrupt, quite rude. But, you know, it was a free ride back. So, anyway, he dropped me in New York, said goodbye and thank you. The next day, he showed up at the office at lunchtime.
In your office?
Mm-hmm, in New York.
In New York.
And he had come in for an eye appointment, come into the city, for an eye appointment. And he came, he hit the office just at lunchtime. And so we went out and had a sandwich. And from that time on, he called. What frequently I would do would be take the A train, which was a subway of song fame. It's the subway that went up to Harlem. But it went up to the 125th Street Ferry, which no longer exists. And that was the only way you could get across the river, unless you went all the way up to the George Washington Bridge, which was reasonably new in those days. That was up at 160-something, and the 125th Street Ferry also went over to New Jersey. So I'd get off at the 125th Street Ferry, ride the ferry across the river, and your father would meet me on that side. We'd go out to dinner someplace in New Jersey, like Howard Johnson's, and then he would drive me back. I did not take the subway and the 120, and the ferry back. He'd drive me back and then have to drive all the way back to New Jersey. And then he introduced me to the Reeses and the McKelveys, who were newlyweds. And I met all the people that started out in Middle Village. That was the apartment complex that all these young engineers lived in, usually with a roommate. And then as one would peel off and get married, the other one would have to find another roommate and rotate to another apartment. But the Myers started there, Alice and Marvin Meyer, the Casleys, the McKelveys, the Hines, the Reeses. All these young people, it was a new, the apartments were a living room, a bedroom, a small bathroom, and a kitchenette. The living room was not this big. It was probably as big as that.
That was down at Patterson or something.
It was in Clifton, next to Patterson. But, so that's how I met your father.
Where were you working at the time?
Charles of the Ritz. It was very difficult to get a job in those days. This was, that's why your father stayed in the East, because he was offered a job at Curtis Wright, Curtis Electric Propeller Division of Curtis Wright Corp. He was an electrical engineer, of course. And so this electric propeller was a brand new business. And originally the propeller and everything division had been up in Buffalo, New York, and that's where Reese started, and Marvin Meyer. Kurt was a year or two younger, so that he... But, anyway, that's why he was hired, because he was an electrical engineer. Plus, the chief engineer had also graduated from Yale, and that didn't hurt Kurt one single bit. Kurt was the fair-haired boy for quite a while, until he became too darn independent. And with a large corporation, you really can't be that independent. But Kurt was there. Kurt's the one that introduced Bill McKelvey. Bill had broken his back. Had spun in an airplane.
Right.
And broken his back, which prevented him from flunking out of Yale. His grades were just terrible because he was quite a playboy. And so they kept him. Mrs. McKelvey went and pled his case to the dean, and they said, oh, well, poor Bill, he just broke his back. We'll take him back again next year. So he graduated a year later than Kurt because of that. And so he came, and Hickenlooper came to Curtis. The first day your father went to work, he was living in a boarding house in Clifton. He didn't know a soul at Curtis. And they were still in Patterson at the Wright Aeronautical. So he stood on the corner and put out his thumb and was picked up by John Reese. That's how he met Reese. But Marvin Meyer, Klein, Marshall Klein, and Dad were in the same office. And that's when somebody put up a sign, I think it was John Reese, Hein Klein and Meyer College Cut Clothes, was hanging on the door up there.
Sounds like John Reese.
Yeah. And then as soon as the plant was finished out in Caldwell, the whole propeller division moved out there. And then shortly thereafter, they started building the hangars and things on the Caldwell Wright Air. There was a Caldwell little airstrip like our Herman airstrip. And I think it took the war. Let's see. Because of the war, the Curtis Wright or the government could take that over and make it a private government type airport and kick all the little planes off. Nobody could fly anyway, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure there were restrictions to private flight during the war.
Yeah.
The amateur radio community basically was put out of business.
Was it?
Oh yeah, you couldn't broadcast. I'm sure you could still receive, but you couldn't broadcast during the war years.
I guess not. I've never thought of that.
Yeah, I've learned that from reading about the American press.
It must have been because, of course, your father used the radio all the time. He had a radio set up down in his office in the hangar so that he could talk to the planes, but that would be a different, a band, and, you know.
Sure, that's not.
But they had to keep people off the,
Sure, otherwise you could hear, mm-hmm. wouldn't be able to find the spies.
Mm-hmm. So. Oh, living in Greenbrook Roadhouse, we had a, there was a huge wooded lot behind us and then a little tiny white house before you got to the Cushmalls.
Mm-hmm.
And in that house, when we moved there, a German couple. And many times we had FBI all over the place asking all sorts of questions. I barely knew this woman. In those, you know, it was a pretty far walk, and she was older than I. But they were suspects, so I'd have people come up to the door of the house in the daytime, and out would come their FBI identification, and they'd pump me for 15 or 20 minutes trying to find out something about this woman next door. And there were very few people living out there, so that I guess they had to go around to neighbors. Of course, everybody was going through FBI checks anyway. I'm sure that I must have an FBI record because of those days, and I know that every employee of Curtis, any wartime industry, had an FBI check. And pretty soon that German couple moved. They moved down to the Oranges someplace. And I don't know what he did, and I don't know what she did. But they certainly were, of course, everyone was suspect in those days. Maybe particularly because they lived far out in the country. And that would have been a good hideout cover. I don't know. They had pit bulldogs. You know, the pit bulls that chew everybody up if they... So maybe that's why I didn't go up to talk to her. Pitbulls. Okay.
Time for break.
Time for break. All right. 2 years ago, when young Bill McKelvey graduated from school, it was thought then that he would go to Yale. I mean, after all, that's as bad as the Hind tradition. And, of going each generation, somebody goes to Yale. So, Dana wrote me and asked if I remembered what fraternity Big Bill had been. I didn't know Big Bill when he was in Yale. Consequently, I had no idea, so I told her to write to Hickenlooper in Cincinnati.
Family History, Tape 2, Side 1.
She wrote to Hickenlooper, and I do not know whether or not he replied. One thing I do know is that this year John and I did not send out Christmas cards. And it's the first year that we have not received a card from Hickenlooper. So you see, I do not know if something's happened to the Hickenloopers or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't heard anything much from the McKelveys since then. I think both the children are at Stanford. Oakley had a soccer scholarship.
Wow.
To Stanford. Did you know that?
No.
How about that? She's the most beautiful girl you've ever seen, Gregory. Tall, willowy, beautiful hair, lovely face. And the gal played such good soccer that, and she's a brain.
Mm-hmm.
And her soccer was so great that she got a scholarship. Isn't that marvelous?
Great.
A female athletic scholarship.
Actually, young Michael Collins goes to Stanford.
Yes, I was thinking about that when you told me that. And I think young Bill goes to Stanford, too. I think they're both the McKelveys went west. Very interesting. Maybe young Mike should look up Dana Oakley McKelvey because she's not only a brain, but she's so darn good looking and obviously an outdoor type.
Oh, I'm sure he's got lady friends that he,
Oh, I'm sure he does too. But it is funny how sometimes these things work. Look at Henry and Cindy. They met over my bad belly.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course, I had nothing to do with you and Elsa. I don't even know how you and Elsa met. How did you meet?
She was the company gopher.
That's right.
I had a company gopher. Yeah, she was the company gopher.
And then she had to quit because you couldn't date a company employee by law.
Or whatever. Let's see. What else? Well, tell me about Dad's side of the family. Start back as far as you can on Dad's side.
You mean the Hines?
Yeah.
One night when your father and I were visiting the Hines before children, we were in the kitchen doing the dishes, Mother Hine and I. And there was breakfast, two benches and a table, sort of built in someplace in that kitchen. I don't remember where.
Breakfast.
So we sat down there with a cup of coffee, and I started asking her questions. She was an interesting old gal, and she, when she grew up in farm ranch country in Idaho, was it?
I wouldn't know.
Okay. Now, I have these notes, so this will have to be corrected because I haven't thought about it for a long time. She rode a great deal, and when she was 14 or 15 years old, according to what I remember, and you should get your Aunt Ruth on this, her parents felt that she should have more of an education. So they sent her to Aunt's in Wisconsin, I believe Wisconsin, where she went to a seminary, which was exactly the same thing as sometimes they were referred to as colleges, but they really weren't of a college level. They were of a high school level. And she ended up graduating and being a music teacher. Now, even the teachers here in town of my age, the retired teachers, when they started teaching, they started teaching right out of high school. In those days, to man all the one-room country schoolhouses, people that were good students in school would be hired at 17 to go out and teach in the community, and then they could take hours of education and so forth as they were teaching. And it wasn't until rural areas, I don't know when the laws went through, but that they had to go to teacher's college before they could teach. But by that time, all these had the grandfather clause. Well, she was very much the same. She went back to the farmland, ranch, and her parents must have been extraordinary because at this young age of 17 or something, she rode circuit teaching music. She would get either in a horse and buggy or on a horse and ride to the Smith's ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Stay there for a day or two, teaching their children music, leave all the lessons. She'd be back in a month.
Right.
Then she would go, she had a whole circuit that she rode and taught, and she would stay with these people overnight or for the weekend and make the little children practice the piano and learn their lessons and leave lessons behind. Well, while she was doing this, and she loved it, she liked that, she met a man named Turner. I found that note today. We couldn't remember what his name was the last time. And she married him. He was, I believe, a traveling salesman. I don't know what age she was. I don't know anything about it. But evidently, they were extremely happy. And at some time. What his territory was, I don't know. But sometime or other, they ended up in Seattle. And that may have been part of his territory, or maybe she even, I don't know that she lived there. But anyway, I don't know how long they lived there. But somehow Turner met Hine, Homer. And whether through business or what, I do not know. So when Homer's sister and mother would come by train to visit Homer in Seattle, Homer was not married, and so Mrs. Turner would be the hostess to show Aunt Nell and her mother, Emma Kirkland, take them shopping or walking with their parasols or, you know, something. Mm-hmm. And so she got to know, of course, Aunt Nell and the mother. Well, she did this several times. After all, people didn't travel as frequently in those days as they have been since. But that's how, you know, they met. Anyway, Homer and Mr. Turner and a bunch of men were hunting one fall. And there are two different sides of this story. Mother Hine told me that Turner was shot. I think Aunt Ruth, maybe your grandfather, Hine, didn't come from your father, told me that he had an appendicitis attack. So I don't know about Mr. Turner. But anyway, Mr. Turner died. So now Mrs. Turner was a widow. And Mr. Hine paid his respects in very proper ways and so forth, and eventually they were married. Now, they were married rather late. The Turners had never had any children. And so Mother Hine, I think, was well in her 40s when she had Kurt. He missed out on some of the fun that children have when they have younger parents. Because by the time that he was growing up, the Hines were pretty darn set in their ways, just the way John and I are set in our ways now. We don't get out and play baseball with kids anymore.
Right.
And also, Dad Hine had retired. Thus, mostly retired. He was involved with the Salmon Bay Sand and Gravel Company. But not very active. It was the Swedish family. Weren't they Norwegian or Scandinavian family? Kurt told me one time, true or false, he said that when he was at Lakeside, you know, during his upper school years, 4 or 5 years or whatever he was there, I don't know, that every night they'd go over to the university district for dinner. That Mother Hine was just fed up with cooking at home, and they'd go to this tea shop. Well, that's a little hard to believe, but anyway, that was his memory. And he didn't have much fun and games at home. His parents evidently, by that time, had sort of... Dad Hine went down to the Arctic Club every day to play bridge, every morning, and would be with his buddies and have lunch down there and stuff, leaving Mrs. Hine. And I think it was my impression that Mrs. Hine always resented this to a certain degree, although she must have had her lady friends. I don't know. So there was, Kurt, your father would never play bridge. Well, he did once, because he really felt that his father, I guess, was being somewhat of a stinker to go play bridge every morning, leaving his mother alone. I don't know why. Because women should be able to have something they do, you know. Yeah. And so I don't know about this. But I know he didn't have a happy laughing growing up time. He did lots of things that, like hide behind the couch when his sister was entertaining a beau. Yeah, he did. He
invented these telephone speakers all around the room long when he was in prep school. He had speakers in his bedroom so that he could take the phone off the hook, and in those days it was a hook, you know, this receiver, and lie it down, and then he could just go about dressing or anything else because he can hear and speak through these speakers. He also had the house pretty well wired so that he could be upstairs in his room while his sister was downstairs entertaining a beau. I don't think she knew about that until she was about 40, and then she was pretty shocked. Ruth was, what, 5 years older than her? 5 or 6 years older. Consequently, you know, she grew up when he was still a little boy, and he could hide under behind the couch. So your father always was very good at electrical combinations. He took an extra year at Lakeside because he couldn't pass Latin. And that senior year, that second senior year, he helped teach physics, I believe. And maybe some other endeavor, but I think it was only physics. And did nothing but study Latin so that he could, and he was tutored all summer so that he could pass his entrance exams to Yale. He was not good at languages. But then neither was I, so.
No, not you.
But you took Spanish for a long time.
Didn't look good.
You were very lucky, though, when you got to college. You didn't have to have languages. Now colleges are beginning to put languages back in as a requirement. They're beginning to become smart. But.
Dad went to Lakeside.
Dad went to Lakeside. He, I believe, was president of his class. There's a plaque way down in the cellar someplace. We looked for it when you boys were very young, before Henry was born. He took me out to Lakeside, and we went all through the school. And he said, oh, there's a plaque around here someplace. And way down in the basement corridor, you know, after all, he'd been out for some years by that time.
Sure.
And what was in the front hall of the school when you graduated, particularly after 50 years. I don't know where my cum laude is at Marion Institute. It's probably down in the janitor's bathroom. Anyway, we found it, and I think he was very embarrassed that I even was interested in seeing, you know, it was some sort of the president of the student council or the president of the officers of the school or something.
Where's Lakeside?
Darling, I don't know. It was in either a park area or right at the edge of Seattle. It was a country day campus with trees and playing field, you know, and things like that. Now, that could have been right in the middle of the city, or it could have been on Queen Anne's Hill, or it could. But.
Must have been by a lake.
Not necessarily. Well, everything's by a lake. Why by a lake?
Lakeside.
Oh, Lakeside, right. Probably. Lake Union, maybe. Maybe it was over in the Washington Heights area, that where the university is. I don't know. I don't remember.
So, tell me about Homer Hines' background.
Well, I don't know much about that, except that Homer Hines, the stories that were told me, Homer Hines grew up in Poland.
Ohio.
And he went to the Case School of Applied Science, which is now, what's the name of the Case School of Applied Science, John?
What's the name of the Case School of Applied Science?
It's Western Reserve.
Yeah.
It's, all right, Western Reserve and Case.
Case Western Reserve is now, I think.
Case Western Reserve. And I don't know what that means. I don't know whether he was there for 1 year or 2 years or what. And he got tuberculosis or asthma or something. And I think it was tuberculosis. And the doctor said, Mrs. Hine, your son will have to go to a better climate. So he picked up his little suitcase and off he went. Whether he bummed his way south or not, I don't know.
He was a happy, bouncy kid. And I don't know how old he was. I'm just assuming he might have been 1920.
Mm-hmm.
So he went south, and he worked for either electric companies or the new telephone system. And he worked his way all the way out, and then all the way up the coast to Seattle. And he got to Seattle and said, I like it here. And what's the Seattle climate had over, of course, he spent a lot of time in the southern dry areas, which is what was good for tuberculosis, whether or not he was diagnosed actually as tubercular or whether they thought that he had it. It was quite prevalent in those days, or what. Anyway, I judge that this trip and living in other climates solved his problem because he got to Seattle, which is an awful climate for any breathing difficulties, as you found out. And, thank you, dear. I've only had one cigarette this morning. I'm being a very good girl.
Good.
He got there and liked it, and I really don't know whether it was electric company or, anyway, he stayed with the same company he'd been with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a feeling it took him 2 years to get there. Again, you must speak to Aunt Ruth about this.
Right.
Anyway, my version's fun anyway, whether it's truth or fiction. And he lived on a houseboat with other bachelors. Lake Washington, I guess. Puget Sound, I don't know which. And they evidently lived, they lived it up. You know, four or five bachelors living on a houseboat, even in those days. So he had a great deal of fun. And I don't know whether he was still living on the houseboat when he met the Turners. And maybe that's why Mrs. Turner entertained the parents, because the parents, he couldn't really entertain them on a houseboat filled with bachelors. I don't know. But anyway, that's what I know about Van Hunt. Once a year, Uncle Kurt would go out to Seattle to see his brother. And before Homer was married, oh, they would go all over the Pacific Northwest hunting and fishing and had a great time. It was Kurt's thought that his mother always resented that, because she'd be left alone for 2 weeks or so while Father and Uncle Kurt were off batching it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's a little hard for me to understand. I think that, well, you and Elsa do it so beautifully. You know, you each have interests, and but these were different times. So that's how, and of course, Kurt Hine and Al Hine, being the only two male Hines, Uncle Kurt became very, very interested and very fond of Kurt.
So now, Homer, how did he get into Salmon Bay, Salmon Ground?
I don't know. Kurt was born in Mount Vernon, Washington. His father owned a dealership, a car dealership of some sort. Very successful. And that's what he, I presume it was an area dealership type thing. And that's from what he retired. Now, I just judge, maybe Ruth was born in Mount Vernon too. I have no idea. But anyway, they moved to Seattle.
That must have been very successful if he could afford to live in Broadmoor.
Well, Kurt said that they moved to Broadmoor. The house was already started before the crash. And the day that they moved to Broadmoor, his father had $7 or something like that. Of course, the crash, everybody's... But if you could hold on, things eventually came back. And I don't know Dad Hine certainly wasn't wiped out, so he couldn't have been holding everything on margin, which is why so many people were ruined. Because they couldn't pay their debt. So, anyway, whatever. Everybody had tough years then. But Kurt said that he had $7 in his pocket when they moved into Broadmoor.
And briefly describe the Ohio Hines. There was Uncle Kurt.
Well, you mean the brothers?
Yeah.
Samuel Kirtland Hine, Jr., or was he the second or the threeth or something? I don't know. No, it couldn't have been, because old Sam is the one that married Emma Kirtland. Samuel? I don't know who was next, Charles or Alfred, because Homer was the youngest son, and then there was Aunt Nell.
So there are 5 boys and a girl.
4 boys and a girl. Kurt, Alfred, Charles, Homer, and Nell. And Nell was in that photograph. I guess Homer was younger than Nell because Homer's the littlest boy. And Aunt Nell's pretty tall, like Uncle Kurt. They were tall and standing in the back, I believe. So they must have been the two oldest. And then Charles and Alfred, or Alfred and Charles, and Homer. So Homer was the baby. Uncle Kurt I met before we were married. As a matter of fact, I met him in the fall. Every fall, he and Aunt Alma went down to Berkeley Springs in West Virginia for the waters and the spa, and then went on down to Florida and spent the winter in Florida. And Kurt drove me to West Virginia to spend the weekend with Sam, with Uncle Kurt and Aunt Alma. I think his parents wanted to know what kind of a person I was, and that was the closest relative. So take her on down, let her pass. The only remark that I remember about that, I passed, obviously, was that Uncle Kurt wrote, or Aunt Alma wrote to Mother Hine, that I wore very thick glasses. And, but otherwise, it worked out. Amazing things happen in a lifetime. When I met Corky Wepler, when Kurt and I met Corky and Bob Wepler.
Now, was Wepler a Yale?
No, Wepler was MIT.
Oh.
But we met him in Caldwell through the Rauschenbachs, through the Avondolios and stuff. He was an engineer, but not for Curtis. He worked for Johnson & Johnson in those days. He'd been shipped out of Chicago, too. And for Johnson & Johnson, pretty soon he almost headed the firm, and then he went up to Bridgeport, Connecticut, and was the chairman of the board of Hubble. Anyway, we met the Weplers, and she mentioned something about Stuart, Florida, and that's where Uncle Kurt went, everywhere. And so I said, Kurt's uncle went down to Stuart every year. She said, Hine. She said, you mean Mr. Hine, who used to sit on the hotel, on the porch of the hotel in one of those rocking chairs, knitting all the time? And Kurt started to grin and said, yep. She said, my family loved him. He was just the greatest thing, and he was just amazing the way he could knit. She had known Uncle Kurt.
When did Uncle Kurt die?
I think it was 42. All those three brothers died something like within 6 months of each other. All of cancer. None of them, to our knowledge, Kurt and my knowledge, knew that the other one had cancer. And, you know, they were just pretending all over the place. Oh, I'm fine. Alfred, how are you? But if it wasn't all in 42, it was 42 and 43, because it was very, it was around the time Kurt and I were married. And that's why I finally bought what I called my funeral dress. because the Hines never came east for any of these funerals. And Kurt couldn't go or wouldn't go. So guess who was always shipped? Me.
John.
And of course, these were all people that I really didn't know. I was a brand new bride. Mm. I didn't know all these cousins and all the rest. So, and transportation wasn't very easy in those days.
So where do all the cousins fit in? So Uncle Kurt didn't have any children, right?
Uncle Kurt did not have children. Aunt Alma, this was Aunt Alma's second marriage. She was the daughter of the Graham Page Automobile Company. Her name was Page, Alma Page. And she was an extremely wealthy woman. Plus, Uncle Kurt made a hell of a lot of money. So the combined, of course, their monies were kept separate. Aunt Alma had her own estate, and Uncle Kurt had his own estate.
Aunt Alma being Uncle Kurt's wife.
That's right.
Okay.
Aunt Alma. She was the grumpy one that I thought was just great. She hated the Seattle Hines because her husband went out there for 2 weeks every year to play with his brother.
Right.
She never went. Or she went once and didn't like it, I guess.
Yeah.
And so she was always very grumpy with she took us to one time when the Hines were visiting in New Jersey, we drove them to Ohio. To, this again was before children, to Ohio, I guess, to see the cemetery and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped in Youngstown, where the Hine house was. And Uncle Kurt had been dead, but we were paying our respects. And she took us to the country club for dinner. And we walked in to the dining room and sat down. And the head waiter came over and said, "Mrs. Hine, do you want champagne tonight as you usually have?" And she said, "Oh, no, beer will be good enough." You know, she just put down. I know I asked if I could please sit in the straight chair in her gorgeous Victorian living room. Too Victorian, but, you know, very expensive. And she said, "Yes, but don't get any ideas. That chair is not going to a Hine."
So this is Uncle Kurt's.
This is Alma, yeah.
Uncle Kurt's wife.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then, does Charles have children?
Charles had lots of beautiful girls.
Those
were Kurt's pretty cousins.
Oh, those are the pretty cousins.
That's
right.
That's one of them. Mary Bark was another one. And Nancy was the third one. And Nancy died in 62. Right after Kurt and I were divorced, I had to call Kurt in Nevada, and tell him that his cousin had died. And the woman at the ranch answered the phone, and she said, "I no longer have to keep track of Kurt. I don't know where he is, and I don't know why you're calling." And I said, "Well, you can tell Kurt that his pretty cousin just died." And the woman said, "Oops, I'm sorry." She said, "I have so many interfering calls from ex-wives." And she said, "I'm very sorry, but I was rude." And I hung up. And when Kurt got back from wherever he was, he called me, and I told him it was Nancy. And she had married Tom Dunn, Nancy Dunn. And she died of cancer. Now, Mary Barkle and Carol in Peru. Carol and Sonny. I'm trying to find. Carolyn, oh dear. Are still up there. Had a wonderful Christmas card from them a couple of years ago with all their children and grandchildren. And did you get one of those? Marvelous. Well, Mary is still in Shaker Heights outside of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, Charles is still alive, though her husband must be up in his early 90s now. He was a lawyer. Charles Barkwell. Okay, back to their fathers. Charles had the three girls.
Okay.
They're pretty cousins. Alfred had a boy and two girls. The boy was the youngest. Metcalf, what was her name? This little book is of great value. Because she was married on my birthday. And Marnie Hine was her birthday. It's the same day as mine. Marnie Hine was one of the daughters. She was a maiden lady for a long time, very close to Aunt Nell, because they were both maiden ladies. And then she married a Metcalf. Not too many years before Aunt Nell died, I guess.
When did Aunt Nell die?
Don't ever lose this little book. I think it's 55. It's on a piece of calendar here. 1955. June the something. I can't tell you the date because I tore off the date sign on it. But it was just... Kurt went to Washington on business in June, mid-June. Aunt Nell died. Okay, I've got it. Kurt went to Washington, D.C., on business.
Mm-hmm.
Aunt Nell died the next night, so I had to call him in Washington. The next day was Bruce's birthday. The next day was your party, and Kurt left for Ohio for Aunt Nell's funeral. He came back. And the next week, I believe, we left for our 55 trip and went back to Ohio, went through Ohio on the way.
Right.
Marnie was the one at the house, the woman who took us through the house.
Mm-hmm.
She was in shorts. And the other sister, who's Eleanor Hine, was the oldest sister. Marnie was next, and Alfred was the baby. Eleanor Hine also came, but Eleanor was in a dress. And Marnie was the one in shorts. Well, they're probably slides, you see. And Marnie went down and arranged the house and did all that work. So that was 55. Sorry, but my mouth's just a mess. Let's see, what else? Alfred was around Kurt's age someplace, maybe a year or two older. He went to Princeton. He drank a lot. He was pretty wild. And when the Hines were there, when Kurt was younger, were in Ohio visiting the family, Alfred was sent out to get some ice cream for Sunday dinner, Sunday family dinner, with all the family members there. And on the way home from the ice cream parlor, ran smack into a pie truck. In those days, pies were delivered on racks in little trucks. Squashed pies all over the street, all over his car, melting ice cream in the car. And Kurt said, Kurt thought, of course, it was the funniest thing that ever happened. Because there was his only rival making an ass of himself in front of the whole family, running into the pie truck. He'd been hitting the bottle in the kitchen that morning. He was an alcoholic.
He's the author, right?
Yes. Also, he produced that movie. Didn't he do Lord of the Flies movie?
I don't know.
He wrote... Yes, I think he did. Mm-hmm. I don't know when he died. I didn't know he was dead until we went to bury Kurt, and Mary told me.
Mm-hmm.
Said that, oh, Al's been gone. I said, whatever happened to Al? He was married twice, had no children by the first wife, who left him because of his alcoholism. And had three girls, I think. Victoria was one of them. I don't know what the others are, but it would be on Mary's chart. And all of those girls who've grown up, you know, they're your age or something around there. But anyway, Al died. So you all are the only Hines left. You see, Charles Jr., who Barkwell, who hit, there was a Sally Barkwell, who hit, a granddaughter, who is at the University of Colorado, or was several years ago, and Mary Barkwell, Mary and Charles came out there. Mm-hmm. Were you there, or was it only Ted? Mm-hmm. You must have been out of town or something. And I don't suppose Ted has ever taken that Sally out for dinner or anything. And I don't even know if she's graduated or still there or what. But she's Mary's granddaughter. What was I going to say? I forgot. Anyway, young Charles, their son, is divorced. And those girls were older than Kurt. Maybe by 10 or 12 years. So the generations are kind of mixed up there. But Charles's name, last name, is Barkwell. It's not Hine.
Right.
Yeah. Consequently, there are no males except you all and Charles of the Hine name in this particular branch of the family. I mean, in this whole area.